Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On second thought, maybe 17 days of protests was enough, for on the 18th day, Hosni Mubarak stepped down. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Comer Science and Education Foundation, dedicated to supporting innovative programs making a positive impact on the lives of individuals and communities.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It's the 11th of February today, and it has been a day for the history books, it's fair to say. So we made some phone calls this morning.
Suddenly, it was broadcast on TV, and there was just a massive roar from the crowd in Tahrir.
I'm completely ecstatic. I never thought I would live to see this day. There is so much celebration in the street. Everyone has gone out of their homes, and everyone is hugging and kissing on the street. And
there's cheers and cars honking their horns and gunfire being shot in celebration.
That was from Cairo, Tamer El-Gabashi of The Wall Street Journal, Amira Ahmed from Daily News Egypt, who we spoke to yesterday, also Mahmoud Qasem from Bloomberg News, not long after the announcement this morning that Hosni Mubarak is going to step down. We reached Amira Ahmed first. What's happening out there? Give me some sense of the people you've talked to.
I've spoken to a couple of people in the business world so far. Everyone is very optimistic. There's a huge sense of optimism around the country. Like people have been saying for the past 2 weeks, even though the economy was hit hard during the past 2 weeks, but there's a sense that like this newly empowered youth that now probably feel a lot more empowered. And personally speaking, I do too.
I don't know if this is a question for a later time, but is there anybody talking about what happens now, about the uncertainty and about when things get back to normal?
This is the question on everybody's mind right now, even though everyone's very busy celebrating and trying to let it sink in so as not to waste a moment on celebration. But yes, there's a lot of questions and a lot of uncertainty surrounding what's going to happen next. We're still trying to figure that out ourselves. So there isn't really a sense of when things are going to get completely back to normal, but hopefully it'll be a smooth process and hopefully it'll be something very positive.
We asked Bloomberg's Mahmoud Qasem when we got him on the phone about the second half of today's news, that after Mubarak, the Egyptian army is going to be running the country and the economy. What will happen, do you think, with the military in charge? Will there be continued labor strikes? Will things happen that might get the economy back on track faster?
That's a very good question because, you know, while the resignation solves the political question, it doesn't solve, you know, the country's myriad economic problems, such as a massive bureaucracy, such as high tariffs, etc. So I think the army is going to have to move quickly to find ways to solve these economic problems.
Is it your sense that they're equipped to do that, or are they mostly doing, you know, what armies do?
Well, exactly. I mean, the armies aren't usually known for their economic or financial prowess, so they're going to have to get in really good people to manage the country's economy, I think.
Do you have any sense of how long people can tolerate this state of economic unrest with the banks and the markets and everything being closed and not functioning?
Well, actually, things have started to gradually open. Banks have reopened. The stock market should be reopening on Sunday, I think. Life, to all intents and purposes, has returned to normal in the past week, with the exception of Tahrir Square.
Is there any sense of not fear exactly, but unease, of worry?
Well, I think at the moment most people are too excited and jubilant to be concerned about what happens next. But I think when the cheer and jubilation dies down, I think people will start to become a bit apprehensive about what happens next.
That idea of next, of what happens tomorrow and the day after that and in 6 months or a year, is an easy one to be thinking of from 12,000 miles away. But Tamer El-Gabashi of The Wall Street Journal told us that if you're in Cairo today, right now, it's just not time yet.
Right now, I think everyone's just caught up in the euphoria of this moment. It's very difficult to get anyone to stop, you know, singing and dancing to really consider tomorrow. I think this is very much in the moment right now.
Anti-government protesters everywhere, especially in the Middle East, have been cheering the news of Hosni Mubarak's departure. It's fair to assume that the fall of the man sometimes called the last pharaoh will inspire other pro-democracy movements in the region. But you know what happens when you assume, right? Change, even change that people want, can bring instability. And businesses, no matter where they are, hate instability. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from the Jordanian capital of Amman.
I'm inside Amman's somewhat shabby down-at-heel stock exchange. In a dingy room, a dozen or so men sit looking at stock prices on a large flickering screen. As the prices fall, they watch their wealth dwindle further.
Things are very bad, not only in our stock market. The whole area is suffering.
Victor Dabouk is 66. He's a retired hotel manager. He's been investing for his retirement for more than 30 years. Since the Amman stock market peaked in 2006, his portfolio has taken a hammering.
My capital used to be about $1 million. I'm left here with about $200,000.
That's a very big hit.
It is. I lost a lot here.
Ruefully, he admits that his wife always told him to put their money into real estate, not shares. But he blames the latest downward lurch in his fortune on political instability.
If we'll keep calling for democracy, we'll never have stability. We're not ready for democracy.
Much further down the income scale, among the street vendors of Amman, there seems even less enthusiasm for the pro-democracy protests. Mohammed ekes out a meager living for his wife and six children by selling knickknacks to tourists. He fears that the wave of unrest across the Arab world will drive the tourists away. He says democracy is a luxury he can't afford.
You need to food first. Yeah, you need food to eat.
You want stability before democracy.
Yeah, before democracy. Stability. You need food before democracy, yeah.
Since the political turmoil in Egypt began, tourism to the whole region seems to be suffering. Hotel occupancy in the Jordanian city of Petra alone has dropped from 70 to just 10%. Other businesses could be affected soon. Faris Bagain runs a medium-sized architectural firm designing office blocks, hotels and villas. He's bracing for a downturn.
There would be disruptions, there would be probably cancellations of projects, there would be disruptions in the financing for some projects, there would be delays.
He says his country and his business have suffered many shocks before. In recent years, for example, the First and Second Gulf Wars. But this time, for once, he welcomes the instability.
Change does not come easy, does not come without a price. But I feel personally that it's worth it. At the end of the day, with democracy and with transparency, it's better for business.
He hopes that a democratic revolution will finally curb or kill the corruption that is throttling the economy of the Middle East. No, he says, democracy is not bad for business. In Amman, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Business was fine on Wall Street this Friday. Oil was down, stocks were up. The events of the day in Cairo helped give the major indices a bump. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The White House wants the federal government to be done with the business of mortgages. It's a little tricky, though, when Uncle Sam owns the two companies that guarantee 85% of the home loans issued in this country. Today, the Obama administration released its plan to fix Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They are, as you might recall from the early, early days of the financial crisis, functionally bankrupt, propped up by hundreds of billions of dollars in taxpayer money. The administration says it's time to shut them down and pick from one of three visions of how to replace a huge government backstop to mortgage lending. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains that no matter which one you choose, mortgages are going to be more expensive.
One option would get Uncle Sam out of the mortgage business altogether, except for limited help for moderate-income homebuyers. Another would have the government rescue private markets only during a crisis like the one we just went through. Lastly, the government would sell mortgage insurance to private lenders. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner says that would protect taxpayers.
The markets would be charged a fee for that guarantee. And if the government mispriced the guarantee and was exposed to loss, that would be recouped in the form of a fee on the broader market over time.
Government insurance, paid for by private lenders, is an idea already endorsed by the Mortgage Bankers Association, but President John Corson warns that cost will be passed on to homebuyers.
Anything that you look at in this proposal, even in our proposal, is clearly going to create a higher cost for consumers.
Corson says the government insurance option would be the cheapest for consumers. That's because withdrawing government support puts all the risk that loans won't be repaid on the lenders. John Taylor heads the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He says buyers of mortgage-backed securities would balk.
Because investors want to invest in something where they can't lose the money, namely a government-guaranteed program, there'd be less money available, and the result would be higher costs for those funds.
Putting home ownership and a ticket to a middle-class life out of reach for too many workers, he says. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You remember back when buying something with a credit card didn't mean a game of 20 questions? Debit or credit? Cash back? Would you like a receipt? Do you have an email address? Can I please have your zip code? If you live in California, that last one is officially off the list. The state Supreme Court here ruled yesterday that your zip code is nobody's business. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Your name and zip code are a valuable little combination.
It's worth millions to the retail community, however they get it.
Eli Portnoy is a marketing consultant. Retailers can use customers' names and zip codes to track down their addresses. Those addresses might show if there's a big market for a store in any particular neighborhood and whether a merchant might want to build its next store in that neighborhood.
And then it's a tool to potentially sell to other people who want to know about that customer as well.
According to the ruling, stores in California can't collect zip codes or use them to track other information. It's still okay for online retailers to know your zip. After all, they need to know where to send those 4-inch heels you just bought. But Madison Riley of Kurt Salmon Associates says collecting zip codes at the checkout is almost becoming quaint.
It's declining in value. We're moving into an era where the young generation of our country, they're providing their personal data on a regular basis.
Even if this ruling is a little behind the times, Eli Portnoy says it may have implications beyond California.
I think that this is an opening of the door to greater and greater privacy protection for consumers in transactions.
After all, these days companies can pinpoint your location through your cell phone, and where you are right now could be way more valuable than knowing where you live. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 43 points today, a 3% closed at 12,273. The NASDAQ edged up 18 points, about 2/3 of 1%, 2809 at the bell. The S&P 500 climbed 7 points, 0.5%, ended things at 1329. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow was up 1.5%. The NASDAQ and S&P both gained about 1.4%. Good day for financials. Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase deposited more than 2.25% today. Earnings season continues to bring mixed results. Panera Bread Company rose 16% after beating expectations. Chipotle Mexican Grill sizzled up nearly 5%. Japan's Nikkei declined 0.1%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions that can help to guarantee income for life. ALLIANZUSA.com. And by Reputation.com, protecting and improving your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing partner to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/grow. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In case you haven't heard, it's Valentine's Day. Markets remain open. In Washington, President Obama is scheduled to release his budget for the upcoming fiscal year. And New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg celebrates his birthday. There will be 69 candles on his cake. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It has been, safe to say, quite a week overseas, obviously, but back here as well. Here to help us with our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, also Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Great to be with you, Kai.
So let's start where John Dimsdale left us off, Sudeep, with the Fannie and Freddie announcement from the administration today. And my question for you is, how real is this? How sure are you that something might actually happen?
Something will happen with Fannie and Freddie eventually.
Key phrase there, right? Eventually, key phrase?
Exactly. Yeah. Eventually. The Treasury Secretary puts a time frame of 5 to 7 years on this. We are probably looking at the better part of the decade before we actually get to any point where we're going to see some resolution to Fannie and Freddie. This is really going to be a test of two things. One is whether the government can take something that it truly seized and make it private again. And then there's the politics of this. Fannie and Freddie are both huge political footballs now. You're not going to really see Democrats and Republicans, when they can't come together on so many other things, coming together on this one very easily.
Lee, what do you think about that decade figure? And also, this is something that kind of has to happen, right? Fixing Fannie and Freddie?
It does, and yet it kind of can't, if you think about really the long-term ramifications here. I think a decade, 5 to 10 years, is realistic. I mean, the changes are so big that they can't really happen in a shorter time frame. But if you think about what we're talking about here, the federal guarantees have been part of the housing market since the 30s. So you can't just pull the rug out from under that. Otherwise, you know, you really put the entire housing market at risk, and it's so delicate already. This is going to dramatically affect home ownership and home lending. I mean, it just is so unsettling to think of what's going to happen to these mortgages, these 30-year fixed mortgages that Americans have sort of become entitled to. So eventually, we would look at a home ownership base that shrinks.
Well, so Sudeep, here's the opinion part of the broadcast. Should the government be in the business of guaranteeing these loans and making sure that 60-some-odd percent of Americans can own their own houses?
There is some valid role for the government to have here. The problem is, because we've already had the government role, you can't really pull back very easily. Given how much we've set up our economy to be driven in part from housing, until you deal with this relationship and have other sources of consumer savings, other real ways to drive the economy than housing out of a recession, you can't really deal with this question of separating it. And sure, in theory, it would be nice if the government didn't have a role, but they've become so interconnected. You may have to get to the point where we've moved beyond the memory of the housing crisis, which could be the end of the decade.
Lee, speaking of the government being involved in the economy, Ben Bernanke went up to Capitol Hill this week, and to my ear in his testimony was very much trying to be calm and reassuring and saying to Congress, move right along. Nothing to see here. Everything's going to be okay. I've got it under control. Do you agree with that? And were you reassured, as the Fed chairman wanted?
You know, I was reassured. I have rose-colored lenses. I wanted to be reassured, so I was. But what Bernanke was saying is true. Core inflation is not as rampant as everyone thinks. In fact, it's quite low historically here in the U.S. What people are looking at are emerging markets, which are growing and booming. So the growth there is driving a lot of this. There's all sorts of other factors happening than just this loose monetary policy that has caused an inflation mania.
Sudeep, you feel better for what Bernanke has said?
Well, he may have calmed people to some extent on the inflation front, but he didn't really calm us on the rest of the economy, the jobs front. He was a little too honest there. Their signs businesses are looking to expand. They're slowed their layoffs. Productivity boom is leveling out. Profits are up. But even he was pretty clear that it's going to be many, many years before we get to any normal sense of the unemployment rate.
Sudeep Reddy at The Wall Street Journal. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
Portland, Oregon clearly loves its food carts. More than 600 of them were licensed in the city last year. You can find trucks and trailers all over the place, offering everything from burritos to Belgian waffles. But some new vehicles have rolled into town, looking to add something different to the menu. From Portland, Dina Prechep reports.
Vanessa Laurie and her husband opened their vintage clothing store, Wanderlust, last September. And their store is pretty distinctive. It's run out of a 1969 Cardinal Deluxe trailer.
Oh, it used to have, like, a kitchen, and this was a bed dining room area, like, kind of combo where things folded up and down. We have a really small dressing room, which used to be the bathroom. It's in here.
The trailer is full of vintage dresses, antique slips, and handmade wallets that match the retro aesthetic. But housing a retail business in a tiny trailer has its drawbacks.
My husband cannot fit in here without kind of bending over. He's 6'2", so...
On the bright side, a small trailer is easy to haul around town. You can find Wanderlust parked at local craft sales and next to food trucks at outdoor markets. And Laurie thinks the size is part of the charm.
When you're looking for vintage, people really like to sort of feel like it's a treasure hunt, and this definitely makes it feel like a treasure hunt.
Erin Sutherland had the same idea as Laurie last year, but she thought a little bigger. Her store, Lodeca, is housed in a 1960s British double-decker bus.
One of my favorite parts of the bus is this spiral staircase. So you come up here, and this chair over here was the original chair for the driver, and I had it reupholstered so that people could sit in it to try on shoes.
Sutherland bought the bus for $4,500. After a hefty remodel, she filled it with racks of vintage clothing and towed it to Northeast Portland.
This is a wonderful location because there is a lot of retail that's directed toward women, but there's no clothing. So I felt like I would complement the neighborhood without stepping on any toes.
Although the bus has wheels, it's pretty much stationary, which makes the permitting process a bit more involved.
It's just a new and very unusual scenario for the city to deal with. So we're just still trying to work out all the logistics of how to be up to code in every aspect.
But even with these logistical hassles, Sutherland doesn't dream of having it any other way.
I've been asked by a lot of people if I want a bigger store in a building, and I can't imagine. This bus is my soulmate.
And shoppers seem equally smitten. Robin Carlyle shows off a little black dress.
I'm 6 feet tall and vintage, and I don't always make a love connection. But can you see how cute this?
It looks great.
I feel pretty.
Carlyle is also running a business out of a cart. Holiday Hair Studio opens next week in a 1964 Kenskill trailer.
I say to my clients, who else in Portland gets to say, if you need me, I'll be in my trailer getting my hair done.
In a double-decker bus in Portland, Oregon, I'm Dina Pritchup for Marketplace.
Earlier this week, the new CEO of Nokia, the world's biggest mobile phone maker, was caught in something of a compromising position. Somebody leaked an internal memo in which he compared his company to a man standing on a burning oil platform facing two choices. Jump off into the freezing cold water, or you can guess the other choice, right? So today, Nokia jumped. The company is going to ditch its own smartphone platform and use Microsoft's mobile phone operating system instead. Yes, it is a tag-team approach to help Microsoft and Nokia take on Android from Google and the iPhone from that other company. But as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, not all the smart money is on smartphones.
iPhone versus Android. BlackBerry versus everyone. It seems like all these companies want to do is steal each other's customers. But the biggest prize by far is convincing those of us who don't own a smartphone to buy one.
We're talking about a market that's moving at a tremendous velocity and a tremendous rate of change and pace.
Michael Gartenberg's a mobile analyst at Gartner Research. He says a year ago, half of all smartphone owners in the U.S. didn't have one. And today, 3 out of every 4 mobile phone customers in America still don't. Charlie Galvin is at Forrester Research. He says these are the people Microsoft and Nokia hope to reach.
It's a very significant win for Microsoft. They're gaining the endorsement of the largest manufacturer of mobile phones around the world, and they're gaining the commitment to their smartphone platform.
Windows Phone is Microsoft's latest attempt to break into this business. It has a tiny share of the market, and Galvin says the two companies will have to move fast to catch up. But Nokia isn't forgetting about the rest of the world. It's still
very clearly focused on the low end of the market, and as they put it, connecting the next billion internet users. which will not be through smartphones, that will continue to be through low-end phones.
This year, mobile phones will become the most common way in the world to access the web, while Nokia, which once owned this market, fights to keep its head above water. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the news slightly off the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Francis Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Jeff Tyler, reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about extremely rich men kicking each other.
Is this maybe about the line at Starbucks in Greenwich in the morning?
No, this is a soccer game between Manchester United and Manchester City, the most expensive game in history. The payroll for these two teams combined is $850 million.
That sounds like a lot for soccer, but isn't that like A-Rod's salary?
Well, actually, if you took the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox and combined their salaries, it would only add up to $380 million.
So at least here in America, we have our priorities straight.
Exactly.
Ethan Lindsay, producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about a pool in the UK that's found a new way to pay for the heating bills.
Which is?
They're going to take the excess heat from a crematorium next door and heat the pool that way. They're going to save about $750,000 over the next 25 years by...
Should I make a joke about body temperature water? I shouldn't, right?
I'm not going to do it.
Matt Berger, senior web producer for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, a scientist in Sydney, Australia said he's come up with a real-life thinking cap.
I hope it's as cool-looking as a Kango hat or something.
Well, not really, but the way it works is it suppresses the left side of your brain by zapping it with electricity so that you can stimulate the creative right side of your brain.
So basically, students who party and suppress their brains are actually stimulating their own creativity.
Yeah, so maybe the original thinking cap's the beer helmet.
There is oh so much more where that came from. Rico and Brendan's podcast is called The Dinner Party Download. There is a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And on a Friday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 43 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ edged up 18 points, two-thirds percent. The S&P 500 climbed 7 points, a half percent. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Ewer. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, reverse mortgages, what they are, and more importantly, why you ought to be careful.
Someone is going to give you $50,000 and say, okay, you don't have to pay us back until you're not here anymore. There's going to be a catch to that.
Yeah, you bet there is. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you back here on Monday.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.